Welcome to The Trail Ahead, conversations at the intersection of race, environment, history, culture, and the outdoors. We're your hosts, Addie and Faith.
We bring on folks from all walks of life to have real, authentic, messy dialogue that can lead to tangible change.
This is episode 14 of The Trail Ahead. We're back after a fundraising break and so excited about our upcoming guests. In order to give you more and increase our ability to really engage with you, dear listeners, we started a Patreon and we would so appreciate your support. So please check that out at patreon.com/thetrailahead.
We've also added a new element to our website and you can now leave us voice messages with questions and comments. On future episodes, we might include some of your voicemails. We'll, of course, ask you first. And we'll also respond to questions during our new debrief section of the pod. So please leave us a message at trailaheadpodcast.com.
Here's a sneak peek from today's guest.
To me, it's like, how do we own these words to mean different and better things for the future, even knowing that we'll continue to have other ways of expressing this? At least I know that kind of like my own cultural identity of being Latino, that means colonizer and colonized. And if I don't hold any space for that, I too easily default to a binary of saying, well, I'm not colonizer. That's not part of me in any way whatsoever.
That is the voice of the one and only Jose Gonzalez, activist, scientist, poet, author, and founder emeritus of Latino Outdoors. The conversation you'll hear took place in January of 2021, though it feels like yesterday. We're going to talk a lot in this episode about the historic and ongoing lack of inclusion and diversity in conservation and outdoor spaces, and how the history of America's environmental movement has caused this.
To help address some of the inequities in the outdoors, Jose is also one of the co-founders of the Outdoorist Oath. We'll link to that in our show notes so you can learn more. Thanks so much for joining us on The Trail Ahead.
Would you please introduce yourself in whichever way strikes you currently in this moment?
Hello, my name is Jose Gonzalez, or my complete name is actually Jose Guadalupe Adonis Gonzalez Rosales. I've at times have said that I am Mexicano by birth, U.S. citizen through naturalization, Latino through social cultural identity, Chicano through social political identity, and Hispanic through census count. Say that with some humor. And my interconnection in terms of my training and practice has been in education. My on the work learning and practice has been through conservation and really outdoor nature related work. My creative expressive nature has been through art and culture and illustration. I've gone from this exploration of being bicultural to being ambicultural to what now works for me as quantum cultural, knowing that you are going to express yourself also in relation in particular to who you're with, and that that collapse of that interaction doesn't take away from the multitudes of you.
Wow.
Yes.
What a great intro.
Thank you. Yes, yes, yes. When we say playing outside, what comes up for you? What do you think of?
Given my perspective, experience, and framing, I've come to accept and understand and appreciate, you know, the different layers of how I see the world. So there is still going to be that academic framing in discourse, right? Which I'll ask, what do we mean by playing? What is the cultural construct of what we mean outside and so forth? So that's there. And much like in a lot of this quote unquote equity and inclusion work, it's a reminder that always be cautious about how we over intellectualize something. That's still for me essential, because without understanding the frames from which we operate, we can lose sight of the fact of what we want to build that's new and different. So playing outside is just, what does that mean as the joy, as the tactile memories of the multisensory experiences of, whether for some that means running in the grass or being barefoot and feeling the earth in that way on a rainy day or on a windy day. What does joy mean outside? The word play to me has particular impact, and a state of play can be an extreme, in the good sense of the word, state of belonging and being. Play is experiencing joy in such a way that you're there with who you are experience of that, in which difference is not a barrier to being able to enjoy that experience together. So that's why for me, playing outside, yeah, it's just playing outside, playing outdoors. And yet it can pack so much, because what kind of state of being and belonging is embedded in that, in a way that for some is just taken for granted and it's implicit, and in others it's not.
Yeah. You used the words outside and outdoors in your answer.
For me, I try to be aware of, like, how do I want to spend my energy? And if I overexpend my energy, I'm like, what's the right definition? And so I say that because outside and outdoors, people have gone back and forth. Outdoors carries too much baggage. It already means so much to some people that by hearing it, they're going to have a reaction to it that's not inclusive. And other people say, well, outside can mean so much that may not include how we want people to connect to an outdoor experience in this way. But if I'm debating too much about never use that, then I might miss the point about saying, here's how I want them to be useful. And outside for me is a much broader inclusive invitation to remind people that there's a lot of power in nearby nature that is present in a community garden, just right outside of your doorstep or maybe on your windowsill. And that I want that sense of connection and relationship to far away places in such a way that even if you don't receive an opportunity to go visit them, that you still have a sense of experience, maybe in responsibility, and saying, I can envision myself there in such a way. And I can now have an active role in redefining what outdoors mean through my visioning and participation.
Thank you for that, Jose. So, Jose, you and I joined Faith for various stints of her run in the film This Land. And at the beginning of that film, Faith talks about the word conservationist. I wanted to hear your thoughts on that word. What does that word conservationist mean to you? And how has that impacted the work that you do?
Yeah, great question. Early on in history was between preservation and conservation. And generally speaking, that just meant that the preservationists were those that say, leave nature as it is, leave it alone, put the national park and don't touch it kind of thing. That's standard John Muir.
Okay. So I couldn't help myself here, and I completely derailed Jose because he mentioned the name John Muir. Muir is known as one of the most iconic figures in conservation. They call him things like the father of our national parks, and he was the first president of the Sierra Club. Like many of the quote-unquote fathers of conservation, he also happened to be undeniably racist, which is evident in his journals and writing. As environmental groups have tried to address the clear divisions and lack of access to the outdoors, they've also had to grapple with the history of racism that the movement was founded within. In 2020, the Sierra Club publicly apologized for Muir's views. Many leading organizations in this space have had to confront how racism has impacted the environmental movement. We'll add some related links in the show notes. Okay, back to Jose talking about this history and how we work to reclaim these movements in spite of their roots.
Conservation was meant to recognize, and for better and unfortunately for worse for many others, was what is the utility aspect of natural resources. So using a term meant to be able to say, how will we use this? And the birth of those terms comes with the context and the problematic milieu of the time. That was when we say these words, is conservation for whom, by whom, who's in the picture, who's not, who has the power of defining and use of those words. And as we evolve in our practice and the use of these terms is recognizing that, right, that they can mean more than they used to. For some people, they're still just such traumatic and loaded terms. A lot of Native American colleagues says, like, conservation isn't the starting word for us. It comes with too much in terms of loss, pain, and what it has meant at our expense. For others, for whatever the reason is, they're not there, is they still think of conservation as this noble pursuit, protecting nature from humans. It can come from a particular place of intention. And it's important to recognize that we have it because we're the ones that mess it up in the first place. And by we, generally speaking, your John Muirs and your Pinchots and your quote-unquote fathers of these agencies and whatnot, that completely left out the Black experience, the Indigenous experience, anyone that wasn't, didn't come from that particular set of perspective of how to view and define, quote-unquote, the natural world. I will use that term and heard Faith say at times, what does this idea of American reclamation mean? To me, it's like, how do we own these words to mean different and better things for the future, even knowing that we'll continue to have other ways of expressing this? At least I know that kind of like my own cultural identity of being Latino, that means colonizer and colonized. And if I don't hold any space for that, I too easily default to a binary of saying, well, I'm not colonizer. That's not part of me in any way whatsoever. I'm like, dude, you got the Spanish are in you for better or for worse. And you're not fully indigenous anyway as much. And that doesn't mean that, quote unquote, Latinos, Latinx, Latines, didn't also have their share of discrimination and overt racism and systemic oppression in the same way other communities did. And historically, we see that in so many ways. So that's the kind of nuance and context that I think sometimes people too easily default to saying, well, conservation is stupid and it's bad. Or conservation, you know, you just don't get it. Obviously, you just want to revert to a particular way of being with the land without recognizing the realities of what we have to face in policies and politics.
I looked up the definition for community recently, and I was like shocked that it didn't say more. I don't have the exact definition in front of me, but it said like, you know, people living together in a certain group or people, blah, blah, blah. But it didn't say anything about love or care or connection in the way that I expected it. It threw me off because I was like, I keep saying community and I have this definition in my mind, but maybe other people literally don't have the same definition of community. And yet I'm here operating and having expectations of how people are going to operate based on the definition that I have in my head.
And community, like you said, just means of the same place, essentially. There, like you said, there isn't more about what relationship means within that. And in some of the movement building work, we've evolved that word to focus more on the relationships rather than just the place, especially to account for community across space and place in a way that it wasn't before. This is its own space of conversations about why we use what words we use. For me, I want to know, this is why the work of agreements is important to me, that even if we may not end up being in agreement around a particular definition, the fact that at least I'm aware of where you're coming from and that I can support that, it's much different than just presuming we both are operating from the same definition, or that we're not, is that then you don't care, or that we can't be aligned. And that type of nuance work sometimes isn't welcomed because it's either you're with us or against us.
Yeah, that agreements, I think I hadn't heard that until I was in some more like DEI type spaces. And I was like, okay, let's come up with the community agreements before we jump into this like workshop or something. And I was like, okay.
I've used this framing of saying, I want to account for at least three things. The first one is whatever types of agreements we need to acknowledge that we're still operating with the system that we are. So what does efficiency and success mean for us? And how are we going to account for that? Because in other words, if we agree to an hour, then that's all we have. And we can go on off all the tangents about how time is a colonialist structured or social, whatever it might be. And then not do anything about it and we lost the hour, or we can be like, we understand and let's honor each other's time that we set apart to make the best use of this hour. But you can't only default to agreements of that nature because they'll tend to benefit those that already benefit the most from current structures. Those with the most power and privilege. It might be someone with the title, like your boss. They benefit from you getting things done according to a schedule that makes sense to them. It might be someone with particular identity, a white male, right, from whom a lot of these spaces were designed. This is normative for them. So be on time, stay on task, all of these kind of things. Benefits by default, it can take a lot more intentional work. The second one, you will have participants for whom they historically, traditionally, through their experience, when they enter a space, they're not thinking, great, how am I going to contribute to being successful and efficient in this meeting? They're thinking, how might I not be heard again? What are the ways that I will be devalued? What are the ways in which I might have to work extra hard to feel like I'm being taken as seriously as my colleague, who always maybe also just gets credit for what I say, but what is it about me? And then you realize it's gender, it's skin color, it's ethnicity, it's language, like you name it. So if we make the statement, we want to be inclusive and equitable, all these things, I'm like, then what are the practices that are going to get you to extend those spaces for others? And then the last one is what heals a harm? Because by engaging in this messy work, it's not a question of if, but when we're going to mess up, quote unquote, meaning we're going to say something harmful. Our impact is going to be different than our intent. We'll stumble, we'll mess up. And in spaces that don't have processes for reparative work, for relationship building, for all of that, then it's easy to default to, I knew it. See, this is another example of how someone like you doesn't care about someone like me and so forth. Compared to, okay, we made this agreement, you're going to try, and that hurt. I want to talk to you about that because I want to know what does it look like to move forward together with this stuff rather than every time that comes up, we opt out or we don't even do this work because we're afraid of when that's going to happen. And that's all just hard stuff.
That really resonates with me. Thanks to Faith, I'm not calling myself an ally. I'm calling myself a co-conspirator in training. And it's the constant fear of getting things wrong. What I'm seeing amongst my white peers is keeping people away from engaging in this topic or in any topic around any of this work. And I think that's one of the goals of this podcast media series is to invite in and gather more folks who can start to get things wrong and feel okay with learning from those mistakes that we will make. I love the way you frame that. Like, I'm going to mess up and I'm going to learn from it and I'm going to go forward. I'm finding it hard to welcome folks into that space because it's not the easiest welcoming invitation.
Yeah. And I feel like what you pointed out, Jose, is that agreements can be made for conversations and can be made for spaces when you can control those spaces. I think one of the places where there are no agreements is social media.
Oh, yeah.
And so if people are trying to, like Addy, you're saying, if different white peers are trying to put their toe in the water in a space where there are no agreements, it's a lot harder to figure out how to engage in the conversation because there are no rules. And I remember it so funny. My dad was on Instagram and he asked me, is there any social media etiquette? And I was like, that is the question, Dad. That is the question. Is there any social media etiquette? And not that every space needs to be tone policed and not that people can't show up how they are with all the emotions that they have. But there are some conversations for which a space where agreements can be made. And those conversations might best live there. And I think some of the questions are like, how can people create some spaces, whether it's in their jobs, whether it's in their personal life, whether it's in their community, whether it's in dinner clubs, whether it's in book clubs, where agreements can be made and kept in a way where maybe they're not going to be kept in a more guarded space.
Yeah. Aware that we have transgressed a boundary for which we need to tend what that hurt can be. Consent language and boundary language is something that's often missing or just said. Set your boundaries. And that's like telling a kid, just make sure you don't hurt yourself. I said, we just are supposed to know rather than thinking about what does that look like? Just like when we talk about self-care, right? We've got to practice self-care. Remember, be gentle with yourself and all this stuff. I'm like, yes, I agree. And if the conditions in the space, if there isn't systemic care, then we're going to continue to swim against the current in some of this. So don't be surprised by how much burnout will continue to happen, by how much opting out will continue to happen, by how much cautiousness will support the default of wanting to do less or nothing at all or engage. And often some of the people we need the most engagement from are the ones with the most power and privilege in a space. Social media doesn't always facilitate that. It was a reminder that social media wasn't designed for relationship building in that way. Like the very nature of social media is to trigger all of the receptor points of like rewards and so forth that isn't going to be like, congratulations, now you get a million social media points because you were actually caring and supportive with somebody else, rather than like you put something provocative and then now everybody's like rallying around that.
Yes.
So before the pandemic, Jose started to run every single day, starting with at least a mile. When we spoke, he was just beginning his third straight year of running each day, no matter where he was.
The first year was minimum of a mile, just so that I could practice the muscles of discipline and consistency, and then just noticing what will come up, and also of encouraging others that to be able to say, look, I did not grow up as a runner, unlike many of you and other peers and colleagues. Like, I didn't do cross country in high school or college or track, or I didn't grow up building those literal and figurative muscles. I got into running much more later. But once I broke through, I could feel like, what does it mean to have this habit and lose it? So this was a way for me to reconnect to that and let others know it's possible. And the first year was a lot more traveling. So what did it mean to run every day, no matter where I was? But it also was just to kind of see what challenge meant in that context, and to succeed, and to experience gratitude of being able to say, my body has held out.
Yeah.
It's because all it takes is a sprain. It takes food poisoning. There's many things that can affect your ability to do something as simple as move your body in that way. And it was a good reflection of gratitude. Coming into the second year, where it was like, now it's a minimum of 2 miles. And then the pandemic hit, and I was like, right, then the gratitude is just mobility, not just physical mobility, but mobility in a space where you have to be aware and cautious and respectful of the call to not move, to not gather, to not be out, to be aware of who's around you and so forth. As I've just started this third year, it's just curious and interesting to see what my body will continue to say about, pay attention to this and what do you want to do about it? So that's what I'm being intentional about that. And then, of course, not just the challenge, but the gratitude. It's like when you go outdoors and if all you focus is on, quote unquote, bagging the peak or that kind of dominance conquering type mm-hmm. of mentality, you might miss the appreciation of where you are. And how do you notice and practice observation of other things beyond narrowly defining accomplishment in one particular way?
In terms of narrow definitions, here we started to talk about the different ways that politics often narrowly define communities. As a reminder, the beginning of 2021, when we recorded this conversation, was a particularly unsettling time for politics. We were still reeling from the fallout of a very rocky presidential campaign, which was immediately followed by the January 6th assault on the Capitol. Because this was so fresh in our minds, our conversation turned to politics.
During the 2020 election cycle, there was a lot of conversation about the Latinx community. And then as the votes came in over a long period of time, you know, there was a lot of conversation about whether or not the Latino or Latinx community is a monolith. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people calling for a look beyond just saying the Latino vote, the Latino vote. Wondering what you thought about during that time?
Oh, yeah. Another great question. It's not a new debate, right? First of all, in terms of what term is used and why. And second is what is encompassed within that representation. In many ways, quote unquote, American Latino doesn't mean anything outside of the U.S. It really only has meaning within the U.S. And even a lot of the Pew Research polls show that there's still a preference to go by nationality before you would even acknowledge any type of pan-national ethnic term. And we still have to create these operating definitions and boundaries to be able to say, what does that mean in the context of not being of the Black community, not being the majority white community, of not being Asian Pacific Islander community, even though, of course, Latino is this interesting amalgam that is important to recognize that you can be, quote unquote, Latino and Asian Pacific Islander. You can be Afro-Latinx. you can be primarily indigenous. And you can also identify as such and be considered white by the census. So it's this spectrum that contains a lot. And given that, it's just, it has a lot of tension, which is important. And in my opinion, it is needed to tease that out, because that will help us recognize how there is going to be a push and pull towards what it means to be white passing and all the associated privileges of that. And to recognize how expansive of a community is compared to how it often, by a dominant narrative, gets framed as immigrant or always new. Even though that community has been here since before the U.S. existed, it seems always means new and immigrant, rather than remembering that a lot of whom may fall within that category are Hispanos that were in the American West before those were states. And that it still matters because it has political implications. And if you look at the diversity within nationalities, you see some clear examples in terms of Cubans in large will tend to be more conservative Republicans. But for me, those are always invitations to say why and dig in a little deeper, and who benefited from refugee status in terms of who's Cuban in the U.S. now compared to who's Cuban in Cuba, across skin color as an example, and who doesn't benefit from that refugee status in the same way that some Central Americans don't or do. And then you can't also ignore that large segments will be socially conservative, even though they might be politically liberal and so forth, and that that's evolving. And so probably Latine, Latinx is one of the most fluid identities at the moment in the U.S. There is a lot of political power within that community already, and it has been manifesting. And then it also makes the challenges of coordination that much more visible and apparent. It's a beautiful mess.
Yes. You are also the founder of Latino Outdoors. We should talk about that and about language, because my understanding is when you started Latino Outdoors, Latinx or Latinx, or when I first saw it, I was like, what is this, Latinx? That language hadn't yet been like introduced in this more mainstream way where I see it now. And there's been a lot of debate about that, even about the use of Latinx. And then more recently, even Latine as something that would be a non-gendered way of speaking.
Yeah. As we speak about the evolution of language and even Latino Outdoors, that was a tactical, even strategic choice and definition. And what I mean by that is it wasn't about, let's find the perfect word, because I'm like, it's not going to be there. And let's not be surprised about the reaction that people will have to that. So therefore, it's going to be important about how we represent it. And so I say that because if we go by calling it the National Hispanic Outdoor Recreation Enthusiast Club, that might be, and I say this with some humor, but also practical reality, that'll be palatable to the National Park Service. But a lot of our community-based organizations would be like, there's another coconut. There's brown on the outside and white on the inside. I know we have comparable examples across all communities. And yet that's, I say that as much as it can sting, because that is what we had to face. And even the very first, with their first set up the Facebook page for Latino Outdoors, that's exactly how I got dragged on social media by Chicanos, who were like, you're probably just another white boy pretending to care and do this stuff just to do community engagement. And that if I went by calling it Raza Outdoors, then I knew the National Park Service would be like, yeah, no, thank you. So that's why I like about that tactical choice. And so it was important to them to say, what can we represent through this? Knowing that our line in the sand isn't the word. Our focus is on the potential possibility of what it can mean and the invitation to help expand and define it. And through that process, it allowed me to engage with amazing individuals who will never identify by that word, who won't associate with it. And yet we have a relationship of respect because of the actions rather than just the word, as well as knowing that this provided some entry opportunities in through some institutions and relationships that were important, that opened doors, not necessarily like just for me or just the organization, but for everyone else that would be connected. Through that, then I can say, why haven't you paid attention to all of these community partners that would never associate with the word, as an example. So for me, it was much more important to think about that network building rather than just saying, I have the right word, so what should I use? And I'm like, well, you always ask. It's always early on in presentations, I would say, well, what is it a particular and specific about the community in your area? How do they identify? What do they use and why? How do they react to particular words and why? Different communities are still evolving, I think, and using it back and forth. One argument I read will be that you'll still have Latino, Latina in terms of the predominant binary gendered conversations. You'll likely have Latinx as the non-binary term and Latine as the gender neutral term, as an example. And those, like I said, those might be ways in which those could all be applicable in some way. And we're agents of our own language, even though we have the Academia Real del Español, which is technically supposed to set our rules for our language. We also know that communities will continue to evolve in the words that feel are more representative of who they are.
Thank you. That is a question I feel like I've had for a while, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. And I know there's so many answers and that the answers are ever evolving, but it's great to have that conversation with you.
No, same. I think for me, it's just been that to say, going back to those original agreements, right? I am interested in doing one of two things. One of is, if I perpetuate a label and I'm not aware of it, then that's important to me. If I support an identity, then that means I have to put in the work to understand, why does someone identify in that way? Why is that valuable to them? And conversely, what harm comes to them? And that's a classic question in terms of like justice-oriented work, which is, what power are you willing to give up? And sometimes that's a very big, broad, heavy kind of question in terms of institutional power. And sometimes the power you have to give up is your own narrowed view of the world in terms of what you think things should be named and called.
Absolutely.
Running is a powerful tool for activism. The act of traversing the planet's most beautiful landscapes connects us to the places we run, transforms us with every step, and encourages us to stand up and fight when these places and communities are threatened.
With that in mind, we're so psyched to shine a spotlight on Patagonia's Run 2 film series, which introduces us to runners who use human-powered movement to advocate for causes close to home and heart.
If you're an avid listener of The Trail Ahead, you'll recognize Lydia Jennings in Run to Be Visible, capturing her during a 50-mile run highlighting Indigenous scholars and scientists.
In Run to Save a Watershed, runner Felipe Cancino, who I had the joy of meeting and running with a few years back, takes us through stunning locations in his home country of Chile and tells the story of a watershed threatened by development.
The latest film highlights Martin Johnson of England as he attempts to set the fastest known time on the 184-mile Thames Path, while also learning more about himself and the entangled history between Black people and the Thames River.
Head to patagonia.com/run2 to watch the films and learn more about how you can get involved.
Hi, it's Addie. I want to talk a bit about how the outdoors has been a healing force for me over the years. Stepping outside and onto a trail is where I can recenter, ground myself into the earth and look up at the trees. Feel the snow crunching beneath my feet, the cold on my face, or the warm sun helping me calm my thoughts. The trail is where I meditate. It's where I have tough conversations with myself. It's my form of self-care. We love working with our partner Merrill here on The Trail Ahead because, like us, they believe self-care and connecting to nature are one and the same. As we all collectively emerge from two tough years, there's never been a better time to try out a new activity or even explore your own backyard. And if you're looking for new gear to help get you there, we'd love to introduce you to Merrill. For first timers, get 20% off online with the code TRAILAHEAD20 at checkout. And we'll see you out there.
So we've been talking a lot, among other things, about community. And within that, we'd love to ask you more about friendship and friendship as a support mechanism within the activism community You're leading people, guiding people. I feel like taking even for granted the fact that I'm sitting here with my dear friend Faith and we're talking to you, a wonderful friend of ours. How does friendship play into the work that you do and the communities you've built?
You know, as we were talking about some of the roots or the etymology of community, it was much more place-based rather than relationship-based. And friendship, some of the etymology is, I think, German roots, the type of love. So it is, that one's a lot more centered on the expression of association and relationship rather than place. So I think about how this idea of an expression of love, what does that mean in terms of relationship with others? And I think it's a way to say, what is the space of love you're willing to extend in which to include others and why and who gets to be in that space? But even I think with relationship, you don't just have relationships. Usually you invest in relationships in which at minimum you establish friendships. And I say this because you can have relationships with people and they can just be transactional, or you can have acquaintances. But usually those you don't invest a lot, right? You don't usually sustain those relationships. Friendship as an operating relationship to me has been important because, one, in a lot of the work that you want to do, the work moves at the speed of trust. And so that means you want to be able to say, how do I trust people? And how do we express and manifest that trust? In others is that you might move in and out of positions of power, maybe even privilege, but also of organizations. And what matters is the people. And so this act of friendship can benefit different things. But at minimum, if you do the work, friendships gets to stand the landscape in which the water moves. It gets to set the direction. It gets to establish the flow in ways that you want things to happen. In terms of your own personal growth, is that you get to actually define this idea of community. You get to be with people that not only affirm, that not only provide spaces in which you can be your full self, so to speak, and also you might end up with people that will push and help. They will be the people that will, just like running, that sometimes they'll set the pace and that's who you want to keep up with. Sometimes they'll be the ones to say, it's okay if we slow down. They're the ones that you experience discomfort together. That's what running, that's what all physical exercise is. It's discomfort. And that they are the ones that when you sprain your leg, when something happens, it's individuals to say, I'm willing to stick with you and by you. In this moment of need. And that can be as big or small as possible.
I love that idea that friendship or the work moves at the speed of trust.
We started to talk about language and how after January 6th, the people who attacked the Capitol, a primarily white group of Trump supporters, were called thugs. What did that mean? And how did that language usage in public space change accountability and understanding of the event?
Sometimes people talk about like white culture, white dominant culture, white supremacy, which it's its own conversation as a whole, is to be able to say, what are the cultural norms? And I think of culture at its most basic is what's comfortable and familiar, meaning like what makes you feel like you belong and what informs you that you fit in or you don't fit in, and the things that tell you that would punish you or reward you as such. And so when we then get to be able to look at, quote unquote, a broader dominant white culture, is that gets to begin to sell the cultural norms followed by the rules and the institutional power about what gets enforced and what gets rewarded and punished if you fit within that or not. And so that's when it's dangerous by labeling an individual or a community of color as a thug. Then it contributes or it begins or confirms the process of how they can be treated accordingly. And it fits within the spectrum of othering, as I was saying, to be able to say, no, of course, now they can be treated differently as such, because this is what that means. That is not new in the history of US as to be able to say why and how we accept someone based on the terms that we use, but also the enforcement of those words.
Yeah. What you're saying about othering and the racialization of these terms, well, it's something I've been thinking about after the January 6th terrorism attack, to have both Senator Schumer and at the time President-elect Joe Biden both used the term thugs in reference to those terrorists was so specific, interesting, shocking, I don't know the right word for me, because I'm like, hold on, thugs is racialized language that you've been using specifically around Black people. And now when these specific white people get to this specific level, you other them through the use of racialized language at the highest levels of our government. It's just interesting to see this othering happen where what I always saw as racialized language used against Black and brown people then being applied to white people, like what if they got bad enough?
Right. At what level do they deserve that word? And I'm also seeing it be like when white politicians use these words, I'm also back to the white community of peers. I'm seeing people then immediately go, oh, yeah. I'm going to other too. Of course, they're not actually saying that, but that's what they're doing in their language.
In terms of distancing.
In terms of distancing themselves from other white folks who committed terrorism, acts of terrorism in this case. But the language that's being opened up to us as a white community by looking at our white politicians using this language, it's become almost okay. Oh, okay, then I can use that too. I can do this too. And it's so problematic.
And it's like a lot of the conversations that have been coming out of this when people say, well, this isn't us. And then a lot of people rush in and say, yeah, no, it is. I think about the no, this isn't us. That may be true. And this is within us. So what I am even much more attentive to is this is the space we have created, supported, from which this comes out of us. Because that this isn't, it's like the debate around intent and impact. If we only get caught up on intent, it's a much harder conversation, because it's like the whole, I know they're a good person. That may be true, may not be true. They might be a good person and a bad person. It's about the impact. So what are the things we can be accountable to changing in ways that are different than just the intent? Because that is a much harder and sometimes losing conversation to have. We're not having the conversation about this is why this is us at this moment. And so that's what I'm thinking in terms of the, are you saying, you know, how convenient that now it can use thugs and white people too. I'm like, that then I'm looking about what is the standards we set to do better and move up to, rather than to debase. And like you said, excuse ourselves from how we may be complicit in all of this work. And so the idea then becomes more about how can I perpetuate this idea that, well, we are the exception. We are magical unicorns for whom this doesn't apply, because now by being thugs, then that's clearly not us. And I think this is where a lot of the people struggle with white supremacy as well, because it's like, well, no, well, white supremacy is that. And so we're clearly not that. So we therefore can't be white supremacists. And again, so I'm saying like it could be true, could not be true, but I'm thinking about what is the system in place that gets to define what is normative that you can benefit from by not having to do anything, and everything will continue to be okay with you. But that's not the same for others who have to either continuously exhaust themselves or be injured by it, or have to agree to be complicit and be a part of it in ways that will also probably destroy them.
Right. And I think white supremacy is such a good example where people can say, oh, white supremacy, that's not who we are, because we're not walking around in KKK hoods. But what you said, okay, maybe it's not who we are, but is it within us? Ask the question of how do we extricate white supremacist culture, belief systems, history, etc., which is in our bodies. So it is within us. And it is interesting, this tendency to put it over there and make it far away so we don't have to deal with it and we don't have to confront what is literally within us as a culture and as individuals.
Because this literally gave a new visual to white supremacy, a very convenient visual to say that's what that looks like. It looks like horns and a cape and these different hats and these different jackets, etc. It looks like this very physical manifestation of white supremacy. And I think that's also so dangerous, because it is within us. It is within the white community, it's a worry of mine.
Those people were the problem.
Exactly.
Those people were the problem. They were why we need to have the uprisings. Yeah. We now understand what a 2020 version of the KKK looks like.
Totally.
And so that's the problem there. I know you get asked a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder how you answer it, because I think a lot of Black, Indigenous, people of color organizers, or just people walking down the street who, based on the color of their skin, are expected to have answers, are asked, what can white people do? What can white people do to, whether it's diversify the park, diversify the trails, diversify my company, all of those things? I know that because you do DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, sometimes called JEDI, justice, equity, diversity, inclusion. What do you tell people when you ask, when you're asked that question?
I say this with both seriousness and humor, right? Own your whiteness and then see what does that mean? What comes with that? Because sometimes you do so many mental gymnastics to not be you, different things can come up. I'm working my way to what I would consider fundamental questions to ask, to then to see what comes out of that in terms of the work that we do. And one of them is, what power are you willing to give up? And then before you react to it and be like, what? Just pay attention to that. What comes out of it? Are you reacting as if to say, well, I don't have any power, or I've never thought about what that means, or I'm afraid, or I'm scared, or maybe I'm reacting in a way that is defensive, that has fragility, compared to I'm going to approach this with curiosity. I'm going to approach this with awareness. I have no idea. Because if you don't, then conversely, the question then is, what power are you willing to hold on to such that it harms somebody else? From that, things can flow out, like how can you wield and yield your privilege? So as Addie, as you mentioned, then how can you be a co-conspirator or an accomplice, as some people say? That's different from being an ally. That's different from being a bystander. And it can let you move in ways that you haven't moved before, because you're overly caught up with guilt. You're overly caught up with less helpful processes. And sometimes people will say, nobody's asking you to apologize for your white ancestors. What we're asking you to do is be complicit of undoing the structures that they created from which you benefit from. And that is a different thing. I have not chosen or agreed to be here to make you feel more guilty. If you end up in that space, or you choose or need to be in that space for a reason, then okay. But that is not a place of action. And if you're ready to move to places of doing, then that's where I'm interested, to be able to say, let's figure this out.
We talk here about how to get started. If you haven't done any work to educate yourself about historical harm, first, it's maybe a book club or documentary. Then, once you know more, you take action. You go to the protest, for example, or join an organization. And then we talk about how strengthening your activism muscles requires not only action, but also practice.
It's like when people make their new resolutions to exercise more and eat better, right? You can have all the information, and even the doctor will say, now go do this and this. That's your awareness. But unless you actually do it, mm-hmm. nothing's going to change. Then you actually have to go and run the mile. Then you actually have to go ahead and eat different. Then you actually have to like do the things. And if you didn't change the space in which you're changing your habits, if you stocked up on cookies and they're just conveniently still there at 2 a.m. and you're like, I'm going to go ahead and have some, you can blame yourself, but also the space hasn't changed in such a way that what you're trying to do will be structurally different. And that's a silly example, but sometimes with people, I'm like, you commit so much energy and resources to all these other changes in your life. You don't get stuck by treating this differently in terms of how you can change things about you, even though the impact, what we're talking about, is in cookies and it is in running. It is what impacts the livelihood of other people, including their lives. It is what has real applicable effect on how people experience harm in the world.
I so appreciate that answer, Jose. And even that we can have this conversation, that I can be a part of this conversation, I feel so grateful for that. I think there's, as we talked about before, a fear or the guilt that you mentioned, Jose, as well. One thing that I've been really taking to heart this year and living by this year specifically that I think I heard originally Fauci actually say, Dr. Fauci say, but he said, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and in relation to COVID. But I think it applies, and that's why I'm so eager to start to open this conversation and encourage more of my white community to join. I think there's a lot of fear that I'm going to get it wrong or I'm not going to do it right, so I'm not going to engage at all. And I think that's something that I'm so excited to be able to start to unpack with folks and welcome more people in. And when we're moving towards action and the doing part, like that's where things get interesting. I wanted to also ask you if there's anything else you want to talk about or anything we haven't covered or anything that's on your mind. We want to open that space for that too.
At the moment, I'm thinking about how the language of ecology or the language of nature, how that can be informative in how we approach some of this work, with the caveat that it's a way to, what I talk about, heal severed connections, how we have disconnected from nature, how we have disconnected from being in interdependent relationship with nature because of a lot of things. So how do we reconnect to that while acknowledging that as humans, we're also... we have this capacity for things that some of our other fellow kin, animal, and aflora kin don't and can at the moment, right? I admit that I don't know if a squirrel wakes up in the morning and says, this is how I'm manifesting my vision for the day. I don't. It could. The bear might also do that. The eagle, I presume they probably get up and wonder, what am I going to eat today? How am I going to stay alive? Like those kind of things. As humans, we create art. We create beauty in other different ways. We write poetry. We listen to and create music. We have the capacity to be this piece of the universe reflecting upon itself, right? A part of the universe, thinking about the universe. The way that we are humans, in terms of biologically speaking, in terms of like social creatures, still affect a lot of what we can do. This is why I use the examples to say, if we are creatures of habit, then what helps us change habits? And changing a habit for fitness is no different than changing a habit for racism, because we still need you to just do different. The difference is on the type of impact that we can have and type of the world that we want to have. I want us to own our humanness as we are also reconnection to nature. It's not an either or. And so when I think about the language of ecology, they can be starting points for the potential of our humanity. So if I talk about the edge effect, and ecology is when two habitats come together. So maybe where the forest meets the savanna or the grassland. In ecology, that is the edge, that's the ecotone, that's the edge effect, that it's a border, right? And so it's a way that nature treats a border as a zone of abundance. It is an area in which you actually can have abundance. And a celloist like Yo-Yo Ma will talk about the edge effect for music as to why he engages with other musicians from different disciplines to be more creative, to challenge himself, to create abundance out of that interaction. And it's a very different way of looking how nature reminds us that borders are these zones of abundance compared to how humans may traditionally treat borders as these very bifurcated dividing zones, like the US-Mexico wall, that border. We can think of borders differently. When we talk about fire, we've learned that if we overly suppress fire, then that leaves it to be much more destructive when it does happen. And a lot of indigenous practices and Native American engagement with fire was a lot more restorative. They recognized that, yeah, there was destructive fire, but there's also creative fire. There's also restorative fire. There's sacred fire. And I think about human conflict in the same way, that if we have overly suppressed that fire, when it blows up, then it's really harmful and destructive. And we're investing so much resources in fighting the fire and thinking about how leaning into tension and conflict that can be growth oriented is like a prescribed burn. It allows to burn away that which is less useful so that the environment you're leaving can be a lot more growth oriented, so that succession can actually happen rather than a complete destruction of the regenerative ability of the landscape.
Whew. I'm so glad that you brought that into the conversation. You weren't just like, there's nothing on my mind today.
Here's some of the things on my mind. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I will say one last quick thing, actually, because it came to mind, since just as you mentioned, you're like, what can white people do? And sometimes we say, what's an individual practice? I was reflecting on a phrase that I came across many years ago. And the metaphor goes, what happens when you squeeze an orange? What comes out? With the idea being that it's orange juice. If you were to expect grape juice or apple juice or carrot juice, doesn't make as much sense. And so it's not meant to just be a silly trick question. It was like to say, well, as a human, what happens when you're squeezed? So when you're in moments of duress or stress, what comes out? And is that your orange juice? And so I think about that because we're going to continue to face just these hard moments, uncomfortable. You're going to get trolled on social media. You're going to be in a fight, whatever it may be. And I think about, it isn't an excuse to not be angry. It isn't an excuse to not lean into radical acts and hard. It makes me pause and be able to say, I want to always be aware of how I choose to or don't want to be in contradiction with myself. And so when I'm squeezed and when I'll still act in particular ways, what is coming out? And that's for me has been a good reminder. You want it to be something else, but it's not because you haven't been attending to that internal practice.
Yeah. And I want to add, I love the way that you use the word practice because it means so many things, but it also is like all of this work takes practice. And you also said building a muscle figuratively and literally. Mm-hmm. And those are things that I think a lot of folks do understand, the idea of practicing. Like, we don't expect to walk onto a baseball diamond and all of a sudden be an all-star. Like, we know it's going to take practice. And it's the same in these conversations. Mm-hmm. You're not going to enter into your first conversation about race, identity, politics. You don't even have a toolbox of language to use yet. You don't even have a toolbox of references, but you want to be an all-star. It doesn't work that way. And it's not going to work that way. And that transformation will not happen overnight, but it also will not happen if we all quit because we aren't all-stars.
So think about what you said. What is your practice? Discomfort is a part of the process. So when you experience discomfort in this social emotional space, it's not to say, oh, I'm supposed to be uncomfortable, so therefore I know I'm doing the work. Is this discomfort growth oriented? And I have to think about, what's the professional advice I get, right? From the nutritionist, from the doctor. Am I paying attention to what am I consuming? What am I taking in? What am I not taking in? What is my plan? What is letting me know that I'm checking in my benchmark? So all of those elements are there in terms of just saying, you have to do anti-racism work, go. And then it's like saying, go lift these 500 pounds because that's what's going to change the system for the better. And then you're like, no, thank you.
Amazing. Thank you, Jose. Thank you for the time, for the friendship, for the insights, for the thinking with us.
For this season, we're going to add in a closing segment called The Debrief. Normally, we'll take this time to jump into something our guest has said and go a little bit deeper, or chat through something like a question from a listener and reflect on that as a starter for the conversation. That was such an interesting conversation, and it was recorded a long time ago, but so many of the things we talked about still resonate and stuck with me for this whole year, honestly.
100% agree. I feel like there are things from that conversation that I'm constantly referencing.
Jose is, for me, one of the most eloquent and thoughtful people in general, and also on the topic of language and of specificity and of why language matters. And I think that relates so deeply to that, the conversation that we're having around defining the outdoors or defining what it means to be in community with others in this space that feels sometimes to be so simple or straightforward. And it's really not. It does deserve deeper conversation. He opened my eyes to a lot of why it's important to use specificity in language that I hadn't thought about before.
I completely agree. And I think it's evident from the very first question with Jose, when we ask him about what does playing outside mean to you? He was like, well, first we need to define what outside means.
Yeah.
And this is a conversation that comes up quite a bit is even, do we say outside or do we say outdoors?
Mm-hmm.
And I think historically, we always said outdoors. The outdoor industry and people who work in environmental and conservation spaces were saying the outdoors, and it was the great outdoors. But for people who historically didn't have access to outdoors that they necessarily would have considered great, right? We didn't do the same like lauding over the park down the street as we did about the national park system, which was called quote unquote America's best idea. Maybe outsides felt lesser than, but I, you know, played outside so much as a kid. And that's like what made me fall in love with quote unquote the outdoors. You know, it was just like playing outside constantly. And luckily, having a safe space to do that.
Right. No, that's so interesting because it conjures up the issues of access that we talk about a lot. And who is your community? Where are you getting this knowledge from? Are there barriers to access? And there absolutely are in the outdoor industry. And I mean, it also makes me think about, in terms of what you just said, in terms of the national parks and America's best idea. Well, that land, as we've talked about many, many times, I don't actually know if I should say this because I feel like it's...
Yeah, say it.
I'll say it. That land was stolen, is stolen, and is not ours to necessarily keep and protect as a federal agency. It's indigenous people's lands. And a couple other our guests talked about this. Outside, that word to me conjures up the idea of physical space and access to green spaces and nature and all these things we have conversations about. And then it's also like, whose outside is it? Mm-hmm. Whose nature is it? Or whose land is it? And am I a guest on this land? But how can we be the best guests possible? And how can we also take that definition of being outside and internalize it and make it the most meaningful to ourselves? Because I think that's where the outdoor industry has struggled, is the idea that we have to fit into this narrow definition of what it means to be part of the outdoor industry or an outdoorsy person. And I'm doing air quotes as I say that.
Yeah. I mean, I extend empathy and grace because every system, every power structure that exists in the United States was formed within a time of racism. And so inherently, there are racist ideas woven into literally every system that exists. To me, that should actually allow everyone to feel not necessarily personally responsible for the system and the racism in the system, but able to be a part of the solution. With outdoor and environmental spaces, it's just like every other system. So the amount of time that's spent trying to say things aren't racist is wasted time.
Mm.
You know, land management, right? Like we have the Department of the Interior. We have all of these governmental organizations like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, like the U.S. Forest Service, and many more, the Bureau of Land Management, who are all responsible for the management of the literal land in our country, including how our forests managed, what amount of resources should be taken out of the ground versus what amount should be kept in the ground, how should industry be using our quote-unquote resources. All of those systems were formed in a time where Native people had been forced off of their land. Right. So you're right. The land was stolen and then we created these systems to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
So inherently, these systems are flawed because the starting point is from a place, mm-hmm. the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
That said, now what do we do with these systems that we've inherited? And how do we find equitable solutions that include reconciliation and include reciprocity? And I think that's where going back to this language comes in, because you have to be honest about the words that you're using and what they meant historically. And I'll use the example of wilderness. wilderness is a designation. So land can be designated as wilderness. And that comes from the Wilderness Act of 1964. And we can share some links for those who are more curious about that. But the word wilderness is defined in the Wilderness Act of 1964 as being untrammeled by man. Untrammeled by man. I feel like, was it really 1964? It feels like that is even like, how could you say that then?
Yeah.
But truly, so to say that land that had been untrammeled by man counted as wilderness, right? And that's the key descriptor. That just says, basically, we only are saying the land is trammeled if white people in power have visited that land, right? If white key decision makers, and I'm saying white because historically the people who were writing these laws were white, male, and moneyed. Mm-hmm. So if those people that we find value in have walked on this land or settled in this land, we define it as untrammeled. But if Native people who were here first, who lived on this land, took care of it, and increasingly were learning, have been stewarding this land as well as living and thriving in these places, if they were on the land and we then literally forced them off through massacres and through war and decided where they would live, if they walked on this land, we don't define it as having been trammeled on. Mm-hmm. So how do you then take that word, wilderness, and celebrate it, right? Because I think I'm on the governing council of the Wilderness Society. Mm-hmm. I think wilderness should be celebrated. I think it should be protected. I think we should use these laws to protect these places. And I think if we do so without acknowledging the hurt and the distrust and the lack of honesty that is also tied up in these same words, we cannot fix these systems that we've inherited if we're not honest.
Wow. I mean, there's so much that you just said that I am taking in this conversation, because fully agree with you. These systems are racist, period. Mm-hmm. Now the time is better spent moving forward and figuring out how we can be a part of the solution with what we've inherited. You are acknowledging what has happened, and you also don't have to say that. Like, the fact that it's racist is frankly fucked, you know? So like, let's also just acknowledge that, and how incredible it is to hear from you that, like, all right, y'all, it's not worth our time to decide that or not. It is. Let's move forward and let's find the solutions. And that just, I think that is a really interesting foundation for conversations across society right now. Because I think a lot of folks are spending time on this, mm-hmm. right? It's like, well, is it right? You know, let's actually have this conversation. It's like, no, it is. It is. And that's something we can move forward with, knowing how can we move forward with reciprocity? Because I think it also relates to this idea of guilt that I think a lot of people feel, and this sense of like, well, oh my gosh, I don't even want to be, you know, like, I can't even believe I'm white, like feeling guilty for actually being a certain race. And I think I've also seen a lot of that, of being like, well, you know, I either denial, right? Or like, oh, well, we didn't do this. Like, it's not me. Or it's feeling guilty for being a white woman, which I'm speaking for myself. Like, I have felt that guilt before.
Totally.
But this is a waste of time. I mean, it's maybe it's not a waste of time. It's like something to acknowledge and to deeply unpack within yourself. But also moving forward with progress-oriented mindsets of, okay, and we've inherited this. It's fucked. And how can we also move forward and find a solution? And so back to what you said about specifically defining wilderness and outdoor spaces and access, we have to fully acknowledge that the land was stolen and that Indigenous peoples were forcibly removed in horrifying ways. And also, how can we acknowledge that and move forward with a progress-oriented vision, with a way that we can incorporate, there's a sense of progress here, and there's a sense of like, okay, we can all come to the table and say and agree, right? Like, it's all racist. And I think the question here, it's really important to acknowledge that that exists and that we need to move forward with that in mind. How can we
how can we do that?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think the fear is, I think of like two metaphors people use, but like, you're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater is what people say. Yeah. And my dad, the opposite of that is eat the fruit and throw away the peel. Mm-hmm. But essentially, I think there's a lot of fear. Two things I want to say quickly. One being, there's a lot of fear of replacement. And there's a lot of fear of our heroes being taken down and struck away. And I think instead of having to feel like you are somehow responsible, people would rather not admit that the system is fucked, right? Mm-hmm. Because if the system is fucked and your grandfather helped make it, what does that say
right.
about you?
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah.
But the reality is like, you know, but I loved how Jose said it. He said, if you come here and you choose to be guilty, right? And Jose is someone that does a lot of DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, like talks and workshops and all those things. If you come here and you're in a place of guilt, I'm not encouraging you to be there. I haven't asked you to be there. But if you choose to be there, like that's where you are. Come to me when you're ready to take action, because that's when I can jump in. That's when I can help. So this question of what can I do? He's like, what are you ready to do? What kind of action are you ready to take? Because right now, if I see you sitting in this place of guilt and fear, there's only so much I can do. So when you're in that place, read the books, educate, listen, et cetera, but don't try to act from that place, because that's not a place of like intention and strength to be moving from. Once you can put that guilt and fear away, you can stay responsible without wallowing in guilt as the primary emotion. Then it's time to act. And what does that look like? Like what opens up from that place?
Because if you're acting from a place of guilt, you're just acting to absolve that guilt. And it's very personally motivated. And I think that what you just said is moving past that is, how can we create real action from a place of, okay, I've dealt with this in myself and I am accepting and I'm understanding and I've done the work. How can we move forward? And that's so interesting that Jose does that work all the time. And he knows that he's probably worked with folks, I'm guessing, who are acting from a place of that, and probably seen the issues that can come from when folks are acting from that place, what those outcomes are, I'm guessing probably not great. So it's so funny and so interesting to hear him say that, because I'm sure he's speaking from experience. And it's probably the most important lesson we can take away from this session. One of the most important lessons from Jose is get to that, you know, like that's okay if you're in a place of guilt, fear, shame, but do the work to educate yourself and to work through that and to start to accept that there's a system that we have inherited that we need to act, we need to enact solutions that solve some of these issues we've inherited, but we can't do that from a place of fear or guilt. And that to me is the magic of Jose.
It is.
The Trail Ahead is created and hosted by us, Faith E. Briggs and Addie Thompson. It's produced by Anna Agogo at Adode Media. Stephanie Aguilar is our editor and sound designer. Podcast art is by Shar Tuiasawa. Check her out on Instagram at Punky Aloha. Special thanks to the amazing teams at Merrill and Patagonia.
Thank you also to our team on the visual side, Tyler Wilkinson Ray and Fred Goris behind the cameras, and Jillian Sarau, who edits our video profiles. For updates and additional links, visit trailaheadpodcast.com. Send us a note via Instagram @trailahead_podcast, and please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thetrailahead. Thank you for listening and for spreading the word. Don't forget to check out our video profiles we make about each of our guests. And to all of our incredible guests, thank you. You make the world better. See you next episode.